and BCE will each own 37.5%, with Toronto businessman Larry Tannenbaum increasing his stake to 25%. The Maple Leaf sports and entertainment teams are among the most popular Major League franchises in North America and among the most lucrative. The Toronto Maple Leafs top the annual Forbes list of the most profitable hockey franchises with an estimated total value of $521 million. The deal is expected to be finalized by the middle of next year after league approval. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Well, the U.S. trade deficit has shrunk to its lowest level this year, but in October, imports were down 0.1%, and exports also dropped. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour of the show. And Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we have been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests and, we think, raise questions that are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. Over the years, we've had a number of conversations about faith, trying to explore why people believe and why it matters to society that they do believe. Popular media doesn't tend to spend a lot of time on these issues, but the attention of the media has been captured by the debate within Christianity over the person of Jesus, who he was, what he said, and what all of that means for the faith. And we've talked with several of the leading scholars in this debate, among them John Dominic Crossan, John Shelby Spong, and Marcus Borg. And you'll be hearing from Marcus Borg in this first segment of the program. Now, not talking specifically about the historical Jesus, we'll get to that in the second part of the show. But in this interview, he offers some thoughts about the way that people experience God across the course of their lives. For many years, Marcus Borg was professor of religion and culture at Oregon State University, and he continues to be quite well known as a biblical and a Jesus scholar. Now, in August of 1997, we talked about a book that he'd written. The title is The God We Never Knew. It is a very personal account of his effort to move beyond the relationship with God that so many people have in childhood and arrive at a more adult kind of connection with the divine, one that can satisfy both the spirit and the mind. And when we talked, he began by talking about the church of his Lutheran boyhood.
In my own case, one of the things I did in preparation for the book was to try to get in touch with my earliest childhood memories of God. And I managed to get back to preschool years, and I recalled that whenever I thought of God, I thought of the pastor of the Lutheran church in the small town in North Dakota where I grew up. His name was Pastor Thorson. So that when, for example, I would pray the Lord's Prayer or say my nightly prayers before bedtime, his face would come into my visual screen. And he was a perfect image for the God of my childhood, thought of as a person-like supernatural being out there. Obviously a man, wore a simple black robe, had wavy gray hair, and he was a perfect image for the proverbial old man in the sky. And then if I make one other comment about Pastor Thorson, as I was reflecting on my memories of him, I remembered also that he was a finger shaker. And by that I mean that he literally would shake his finger at us oftentimes while he preached, and sometimes would even shake his finger at us when he pronounced the forgiveness of sins. And when I realized that my earliest visual image of God was that God was a finger shaker, I wondered for how many other people that was metaphorically true, if not literally true. This is, of course, the God of requirements, God the lawgiver and judge, who has set up a way of salvation, and it's up to us to meet the requirements for salvation, either by being good or by strong faith, but we weren't very good at either one of us. And so for me as a child, my image of the Christian life, even though I grew up in a grace-filled Lutheran tradition, was that the Christian life was about measuring up to divine requirements and doing alternative service, meaning repentance and strong faith, if we couldn't observe the law adequately. And it's that whole notion of God as a supernatural being out there and as a finger shaker that became enormously problematical for me as an adolescent and then as a young adult. And it's that understanding of God that has been replaced in my subsequent life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you suggest that that is one way of imaging God, one way of thinking about God, and that there is another, one that you say is very much part of tradition, of Christian tradition, of Judeo-Christian tradition, even though perhaps not very many people are acquainted with it. And there is a word that you use that this is my first introduction to the word, perhaps others have heard it, to describe a different way of thinking, and that the word is panentheism. And you caution people that they should not be confused with pantheism, which perhaps people will be more familiar with, the idea that God is in nature. What is panentheism? What is the distinction there you're drawing between this idea that God is around us and this other notion that sort of tries to combine the two ideas, that is the transcendence and presence, both?
Right, right. The word panentheism is a relatively new word. I think it was first used around the year 1800 by a German theologian. But the notion which panentheism points to is very ancient. Let me explain that notion by taking the word apart for a moment. The Greek roots of the word are very illuminating as far as understanding its meaning. The first syllable, pan, means all or everything. The middle syllable, en, is a Greek preposition which means in. And, of course, the last part of the word, theism, comes from the Greek word for God, theos. So panentheism literally means, in terms of its roots, everything is in God. That is, God is the encompassing presence in which everything that is. And to say one more thing about it, it's very helpful to contrast it both to supernatural theism, which is, in colloquial language, thinking of God as out there, and to contrast it also to pantheism, which you mentioned, which is the virtual identification of God or the sacred with the sum total of everything that is, so that for pantheism, God is simply right here. But for panentheism, the concept of God that I argue for, God is right here, as for pantheism, but God is also more than right here. And the semi-technical language for God being right here and God being more than right here is the immanence of God, or the everywhere presentness of God on the one hand, and the transcendence of God on the other hand. And it's interesting that the Jewish Christian tradition, as well as other major religious traditions throughout its history, has consistently affirmed that God is both transcendent and immanent, immanent again meaning the presence of God right here. And if you put transcendence and immanence together, I argue, what you get is panentheism, which makes the notion, as I say, very, very ancient. One other quick comment about this. Speaking of God as if God were a supernatural being out there, as in the opening line of the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven," I think that's the natural language of worship and devotion, namely to personify God and address God as if God were a person. And as the natural language of worship and devotion, I don't think there's anything wrong with it at all. It's only when we literalize that language and begin to think that God, if God exists, really is a supernatural being out there, that it causes problems. So I think when the Jewish-Christian tradition has spoken in a more reflective kind of way, it has pretty consistently spoken of God with a panentheistic model, that is, God as right here as well as more than right here. Let me say 30 seconds more about this. A short phrase from the great German Lutheran theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer spoke of God as, quote, the beyond in our midst, end of quote. And that affirmation that God is the beyond, that is, God is more than the sum total of everything, but also right here, that is the understanding of God that I'm arguing for in this book. And as you yourself mentioned, you hadn't run into the term panentheism before. I find that to be true for many people, including many people with theological educations and seminaries and so forth. And I don't really care whether one calls it panentheism or something else. It's the notion that underlies it that seems to me to be so crucial for an adequate and nourishing understanding of what the religious life is about.
It's certainly not our intention in this conversation to proselytize. And so perhaps for people who are not part of the Christian tradition or maybe are not part of any religious tradition may say, well, they're not – this conversation doesn't touch them in any way. And maybe we could set them aside for a moment. For people who are Christian or perhaps once were or Jews for that matter, why does this matter? Why does this question of the image of God, and particularly these two images, the one model that you call the monarchical model, which is sort of the first one that we talked about, and the other, which you call the spirit model, which is sort of the second, and why does it matter?
Once again, a very fine question. It matters, of course, in many ways, and let me say something about the two different models for a moment before commenting upon the differences that they make. What I and a number of other scholars call the monarchical model of God is a way of imaging God that speaks of God primarily as king, which, of course, is where it gets its name, the monarchical model. And synonyms for God as king are God as Lord, or even in most cases, God as Father, because it's the ancient patriarchal father that is in mind, who is like a little king in relationship to his family. And the monarchical model of God, God is king, typically goes with thinking of God as a supernatural being out there. And I argue that thinking of God that way has consequences for our view of nature, society, gender, and the central dynamic of the religious life. To say something very briefly about each of those, thinking of God as a king enthroned in heaven or as the Lord in heaven leads to a radical separation between the sacred, or God, terms which I use interchangeably, and nature, that is, the created world. Creation is understood as an act that happened a long time ago in which God created a universe separate from God's self. And God rules over the creation, and we as human beings are like little kings in relationship to creation. We have been given dominion over it. So it leads to a radical, to use a phrase from Max Weber at the turn of the century, it leads to a radical disenchantment of nature. Nature is nothing special. Nature is simply there for us and for our use and so forth. With regard to society, the image of God as king, the monarchical model, again, typically goes with hierarchical political systems with a central authority figure at the top. And normally the language of God as king has been used to endorse or to legitimate these hierarchical, most commonly politically oppressive and economically exploitative political systems. The king is ordained by God or rules by divine right or whatever. And finally, of course, the monarchical model of God is also a male image, and hence historically has gone with systems of patriarchy in which a few men rule over all other men and all women and children, and that system of patriarchy is mirrored in the family as well. And then the last element I develop in the consequences of the monarchical model harks back to that image of Pastor Thorsen as a finger shaker. The monarchical model of God images God as a lawgiver and judge, for that's who the king was in these ancient societies in which the image originated. And thus it leads to an image of us in relationship to God as subjects, as peasants, as not much, as it were. And we are disobedient and disloyal subjects who have offended the king, and therefore sacrifice has to be offered. And in order for the sacrifice, whether it's temple sacrifice in the case of ancient Judaism, or whether it's Jesus' death on the cross as a sacrifice for sins, sacrifice becomes the means whereby God can then forgive God's disobedient subjects, and we participate in that forgiveness by believing in all of this. And so it leads to an image of the Christian life and the religious life as one of measuring up, of constantly being on trial. The contrasting image of God that I develop, I call a spirit model. Again, I argue this is deeply biblical, as well as rooted in the Christian tradition. And by the way, these same images can be found in other religious traditions. I see myself as a non-exclusivistic Christian, meaning a strongly committed Christian, but one who affirms that, of course, God, the sacred, is known in other religious traditions too. And these same families of images are found in other traditions. So it applies by extension to other traditions, even as I focus on the Christian one. Anyway, the spirit model of God is very, very different. It's a panentheistic model, of course. God is the encompassing spirit in whom we live and move and have our being. And it leads to a very different image of nature, society, gender, and the religious life itself. Let me make that very brief by commenting that spirit in the biblical tradition is not really an abstraction as it tends to be for us. It has a fairly concrete meaning, and we can see that meaning by realizing that the word we translate spirit in both Greek and Hebrew, in Hebrew ruach and in Greek pneuma, that word in both Greek and Hebrew means both wind and breath. So the spirit of God is the wind that moves outside of us as well as the wind that moves inside of us, that is our breath. And thus, God as spirit is not distant from the world, but is the presence and the life force and the energy that moves throughout all of creation, even now. It suggests an image of the religious life of being in relationship to that spirit which is as close to us as our own breath, as our own breathing, and which is our source of life, not just in the distant past, but in every moment of time. And hence it also subverts or negates hierarchical social orders and gender identifications and so forth.
Within many religious traditions, there seem to be both of these kind of models of the deity, that is, the monarchical and the spirit. Some seem to stress one more over the other. And I think that it's fair to say, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that within the major monotheistic traditions, that the monarchical model has been the one that's gotten more attention, and the idea of this the more present, imminent God has not. And I'm curious as to why that is, and if indeed you feel that assertion is correct, why that is.
I think the assertion is correct. And Karen Armstrong, for example, in her best-selling book, The History of God, traces the relationship between these two models of God throughout the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions. And it seems that in ancient times, and essentially in every century, there is a minority voice which speaks in a more mystical way about God as the spirit who is present to us right now. And then the more widespread popular voice that speaks of God as a supernatural being out there who wills primarily that we believe in such a God and live according to that, to the will of God and whatnot. As to why the monarchical model has been the more common one. In some ways, it's simpler to understand. That is, to personify God and speak of God as if God were a person-like being puts God into an immediately understandable category. I think many of us have difficulty imagining an everywhere present spirit who also has the personal qualities of presence. I think also the monarchical model of God historically has performed a number of important functions for society. It's been the primary means of social control in most pre-modern societies. We have to imagine very hard, I think, to realize that in these pre-modern societies, most small towns and villages did not have policemen, for example. Well, why would people follow the law, the rules of society? Because they strongly believed that there was an all-seeing, supernatural reality who kept track of their deeds and who would reward or punish them either at the Last Judgment or through karma, as in an Eastern religious tradition. So the monarchical model of God performed an important function in terms of social control in these pre-modern societies. And finally, I think the monarchical model of God can more easily be taught, as it were. You can learn about God as the big eye in the sky and learn that you don't get something for nothing and therefore you have to measure up to this reality and so forth. And all that, I think, at sort of a childhood level of understanding makes a great deal of sense. It's an example of what William James called secondhand religion. We learn the beliefs of others and then try to believe them. That's how the notion of the monarchical God was transmitted. But the notion of God as spirit is essentially something one learns through experience. And until one has, at least for most people, I think, until one has experienced the presence of the sacred in nature or in daily life in some way, it doesn't really occur to one to think, my God, the sacred is right here and not somewhere else. Mm.
It seems that right there, you put your finger on the difficulty that some people would have with the notion of the spirit God. And as you say, because it appeals to the mystical dimension, something that some folks, I think, would despair of ever feeling. Mm-hmm. And you say that, you know, the evidence for this conception of God is there because some people indeed have reported that, and not just Christians, but people of other faith.
Right.
There's a very nice quote from St. Augustine in the book, which you mentioned, that is this: before experiencing God, you thought you could talk about God. When you began to experience God, you realize what you are experiencing you cannot put into words, which is in a thumbnail, which is a way of describing the mystical experience, as so many writers have
right.
talked about it.
Right.
It is something that's very difficult to put into words, and
yeah.
it's not an experience that very, very many people get to have. Is that, in fact, an experience that anyone could have?
There's a considerable debate about that in the scholarly world, about whether everybody is capable of mystical experience or whether some people, because of personality type or whatnot, are not. Let me go on immediately, though, to point out that such experiences are more common than we typically think, and more people have them than we commonly think. For example, Andrew Greeley, the well-known Catholic priest, sociologist of religion, and novelist, in a book published in 1973 or 4, Ecstasy as a Way of Knowing, which is a study of religious experience, and he's updated the findings of this book several times in the 20 years or so that it's been out. He reports that in a national sample of 1,500 people, 48% of them have had at least one experience that falls into the category of mystical experience, and roughly 10% of the total have such experiences frequently. Now, many of these people have not known that those were mystical experiences, didn't have that language for them and so forth, but have experiences which clearly fall into that category. So such experiences may be more common than we think, and they probably were more common in the pre-modern world than in the modern world. I mean, there's something about the nature of modern society that leads us to live on the surface of things with our attention focused on production and consumption and with constant noise, I mean, muzak everywhere even. That's kind of, continually focuses us on the surface of things. And mystical experience involves a non-ordinary state of consciousness, which has much more to do with the depths of things. So such experiences throughout human history may have been much more common than they are today, but even today they're relatively common. And then I would immediately add, if these experiences are experiences of the sacred, and I think there are very persuasive reasons for saying that they are, it follows immediately from that the sacred, or God, is not simply an article of belief, but an element of experience. And if the sacred can be experienced, then the sacred is in some sense right here, and not, a long way away beyond the universe and so forth. Last quick comment on that, if I may. The point of all of this, though, is not to have such experiences. That is, we can turn mystical experience into another consumer item, I suppose, and set out to try to have such experiences. But the point of the religious life, as Houston Smith puts it, is not to experience altered states, that is, these mystical experiences, but it's to develop altered traits. That is, the purpose of the religious life is that transformation of the individual self into becoming a more and more compassionate being, and mystical experience can be a tremendous aid and boost in that process of transformation. But being Christian itself is not primarily about having such experiences, even though I think such experiences point to the truthfulness of the central claims of the religious tradition.
That's Marcus Borg. He was a guest on our program. Then we called it Focus 580 in August of 1997. We talked about his book, The God We Never Knew. The subtitle is Beyond Dogmatic Religion to a More Contemporary Faith. He's the author of many books about religion, as well as the novel Putting Away Childish Things. That was just published last year. He is canon theologian at Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. For many years, he was professor of religion and culture at Oregon State University. He retired from there in 2007. This year, our program turned 30, and we're celebrating that fact by digging into our tape collection, looking for interesting people with things to say about important subjects. These are shows that are not part of our web archive, and in most cases have not been heard since they were first broadcast. We're calling it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place to leave a comment. You may also write 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois. The zip is 61801. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Sorry. Wrong number.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with soul singer Howard Tate. He got a second chance after he walked away from his career and eventually became homeless. He died last week at the age of 72. Also, Werner Herzog talks about his documentary Cave of Forgotten Dreams. It's now on DVD. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is available at 351-7958.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, as I said at the opening of the program, over the years we've talked with a number of scholars, Marcus Borg among them, who have asked questions about Jesus. What could be known for certain about what he said and what he did? They're known collectively as the Jesus Seminar. These men and their work have been very controversial, so much so that listeners asked us to bring on one of their critics, and we did that, Luke Timothy Johnson, professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. He was a guest on our show in November of 1996. We talked about his book, The Real Jesus, The Misguided Quest for the Historical Jesus and the Truth of the Traditional Gospels. And I asked him to talk about his points of disagreement with the work of the Jesus Seminar.
It is a little difficult to say what my most my greatest objection is, because I really do have several. But let me try to briefly enumerate them. Number one, although by no means am I a historical skeptic, I think that we can say some things historical about the human figure of Jesus. I think that the claim to a kind of scientific historical knowledge being promulgated, for example, by the Jesus Seminar or by Crossan and Borg and others, and Spong, whom you just mentioned, is actually not very good history. So one of my problems is that the methods of history are not very good, and I could be glad to talk about that. A second problem that I have is that what claims to be history is really a kind of crypto-theology. That is to say, that while the pretense is that one is doing a disinterested historical study of an ancient figure, what is really at work is a kind of cultural revisionism within Christianity itself. So it's a theological or cultural project rather than simply a scholarly project. The third difficulty I have is that the enterprise, especially as personified by the Jesus Seminar, which has deliberately courted the media and done this dance with the media, is that it has bypassed the normal process of peer review of the academy or the discussion within the church of issues of faith, and has put Jesus into play in the media much the way that O.J. Simpson or Susan Smith is, that the media, which is incapable of examining hardly anything at depth besides scandals, elections, and personalities, is now the forum for debating the identity of Jesus. The fourth problem, or is it five? I don't know. Anyhow, then I'll stop.
Okay.
Just to lay out on the table,
sure,
you know, the cards that I'm playing. Finally, let me say that I think that what has happened here has been that the claim to represent scholarship, which in fact is not true, there's a great many critical scholars who don't agree with these findings, but the claim to represent critical scholarship has, in my view, and this is what led me finally to write my book, has, in my view, had a really bad effect on people who are not in a position to judge scholarship. And this in two ways. First, for people who still think that scholars are in the truth business and that, you know, to be a scholar is really to be an expert, I think it has shaken up some people in their understanding of Jesus and understanding of their faith, and they don't know what to think. So because of the implied authority of scholars within our country, although it's barely vestigial, but nevertheless it has some impact, some people really are shaken up. But for me, the more disastrous result has been the fact that a huge portion of Christianity in this country, which is already anti-intellectual and already convinced that biblical scholars are hostile to the faith and undermine the faith and are bad for believers, find in these lucubrations absolute confirmation of their suspicions. And so what is happening is that an already deep chasm between faith and the intellect, which is found in so much American Christianity, is driven even deeper and wider.
Well, I would like to go back and try to talk about each of these things in some depth if we can, and also we'll bring in whatever callers we have.
Sure.
To take them slightly out of order, to go back to your point about your concern that these scholars have, in a sense, engaged perhaps a bit too much in self-promotion, have
mm-hmm.
courted the media, have bypassed the peer review that would come by having other thinkers, academic theologians, Christian scholars, historians, whatever, really examine their analysis and go over it and look for problems and so forth. What to me I think is interesting is the fact that it has been picked up by the popular media, and that the great number of books, a significant number of books that have been written by Crossan and Spong and others, have indeed proven very popular. And I am curious about why you think that is, why it is that this sort of approach to thinking about Christianity and thinking about Jesus has grabbed so many people.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things. It's a very good question. And I think that, first, I think the media tends to pick up what is crafted for the media. The Jesus Seminar really was crafted from the beginning to be a media creature. Understanding that the American media does three things well, elections, personalities, and scandals, what the Jesus Seminar did was hold a yearly election with colored beads concerning a personality, Jesus, which yielded a scandal, namely some shocking announcement, you know, that Jesus did not predict the end of the world and so forth and so on. So I think that the answer to why it appealed so much to the media was because it was crafted for the media. And certainly the publishing houses like Harper San Francisco that are also very cunning and understand marketing very well, certainly even in their asking me to write a book that countered these folks, are much more interested in generating sales than they are in shaping culture. Let's face that right up front. Mm. The deeper part of your question is, what is it in this that appeals to people? And I think it should be fairly obvious that a great deal of Christianity today, mainstream Christianity, has not preached the Jesus of the Gospels, that is to say, the human Jesus, in a way that is attractive and convincing and powerful. There's too little preaching generally. Some of the criticisms of the church made by Robert Funk, for example, although they tend to hit below the belt, are not entirely beside the point. There's forms of Christianity that are virtually kind of a baptized paganism, except that's a slur on paganism. You know, Jesus is my business partner. You know, Jesus is the guarantor of my success. Jesus makes my problems go away. This version of Jesus, which is a culturally comfortable Jesus, it doesn't resemble the Jesus in the Gospels. And that Jesus has been preached far too little. And so there is a kind of a spiritual hunger for a meaningful grasp of the central symbol of Christianity, who is the figure of Jesus. My difficulty is not with that hunger, but that people are being fed stones instead of bread.
I suppose that some people would say the important thing about Christianity, or in fact any religion, is that it provides guidance on how one ought to live and how one thinks about one's place in the world, how you relate to others, and that it is that perhaps that agenda about life as it's lived in this realm is what's most important. And given that, I mean, if one believes that that is true, then the divinity of the prophet perhaps is not so critical. So in that sense, does it really, you know, people have been critical of the Jesus Seminar and others who've written in this vein because of their questioning of the idea of the divinity of Jesus, and in fact questioning the story of the resurrection. If one sort of accepts that indeed what religion is about is guidance in living, does it really matter if, in this particular case, Jesus was the Son of God and did rise from the dead?
Oh, you've got about five questions there. Let me pick one and go with it. And to some extent, your question, of course, reflects the kind of American consumerist approach to reality. And that is, religion is another commodity that suits my needs, and therefore I'm going to shop for the one that works for me. The question of whether it matters whether Jesus rose from the dead or whether Jesus is divine, in order to accomplish a sound ethical teaching or something, you know, a way of life, as you say it, is about as irrelevant as the question of whether or not there ought to be a Pacific Ocean. If there is a Pacific Ocean, it has to be negotiated. Okay? Mm-hmm. So in other words, what defines Christians as Christians is a certain given apprehension of reality, namely that what is said about Jesus has a valorization, has an element of truth to it. It's not negotiable for Christians to say, well, he might have risen from the dead or he might not have risen from the dead. That's what we mean by the Christian creed. We say He crucified under Pontius Pilate, suffered, died, and was raised from the dead. So in that sense, the resurrection of Jesus is, for Christians, the Pacific Ocean. It's not a question of whether it ought to be there or whether it needs to be there. It's there. So the question is, how do you get across it, or how do you swim in it, or how do you build a house next to it? So this is, but the question is a very good one, because in one sense it leads me to part of my difficulty with this kind of scholarship, which is that it wants to be Christian, but it wants to avoid the fundamental reality of Christianity, which is that it is not the human figure of Jesus as such, which is normative for Christianity, but the resurrected Jesus who is depicted in the Gospels, okay? Mm-hmm. And what happens in these historical reconstructions, almost invariably, and this was pointed out already by Albert Schweitzer in his 1906 classic, which described the previous 150 years of the first classic quest for the historical Jesus, namely that when a scholar sets out to reconstruct the real Jesus, the historical Jesus, invariably it turns out to look like the scholar. Or as T.W. Manson, another great scholar, once said very cryptically, "By their lives of Jesus ye shall know them." And so I find it mildly amusing, but also disconcerting, that late 20th century academics in North America, who are all terribly politically correct, multicultural, inclusive, egalitarian, should, quel surprise, depict the Jesus who is egalitarian, multicultural, politically correct, non-judgmental, not terribly Jewish, certainly not divine, doesn't talk about sin. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So what you have going on here is a massaging or a manipulating of a symbol. These guys, like many contemporary thinkers, really do not perceive the Christian reality as a revelation about reality, but rather as a human construction. And they are clever enough to realize that if you want to change people's structures or social structures or political activities, then you change their symbols. Jesus is the central symbol of Christianity. Let's change Jesus. We change the shape of Christianity. So we don't want Christianity to be otherworldly. We don't want it to be pious. We don't want it to be detached from the world. We want it to be on the cutting edge of social action. We want it to be inclusive and non-judgmental and all these things. You craft the image of Jesus to yield exactly that result. I have severe problems with Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan and others for their scholarship and for a certain amount of cultural revisionism. But I think they're good people. I think they're sincere people. And I think that what they are trying to do is to make Christianity in some sense culturally relevant. That is to say, they have certain real cultural values that they are advocating. And, you know, they want Christianity to be socially relevant. They want it to be down to earth. They think it's important that people be inclusive, that people be regarded with respect and so forth. I do also, by the way. I'm scarcely against those values. So I don't want by any means to imply or to let the listeners to this program draw the inference that the people of the Jesus Seminar or these scholars who I'm in dispute with are somehow at the heart of the corruption of the American fabric or some such thing. No. But secondly, I do think that it's important what sort of image of Jesus is appropriated by Christianity and what manner of life that leads to. And I spoke earlier about what I characterized as a kind of late 20th century academics fantasy of a Jesus who has all of these sort of politically correct attitudes and so forth. In some sense, this is a culturally very comfortable Jesus for especially academics and people who live in that kind of world. What I think at some level is being avoided is the very powerful and very shocking image of Jesus that is inscribed in the narratives of the Gospels and is also found in the letters of St. Paul, the earliest Christian writer. And that is not an image of Jesus who is a triumphant, heavenly figure, not that of a Jesus who is a good Republican and, you know, wants prayer in schools, not a Jesus who says anything about abortion or homosexuality or any such thing, but a Jesus who puts himself at the service of others to such an utter degree that he actually gives away his life in obedience to God and in service to others. Now, I submit to you that this is a profoundly countercultural image, that if there's anything that characterizes 20th century America, for example, it's individualism, it's narcissism, it's success and competition, it's a lack of cooperation, it's a looking out for number one, and that if the Jesus Seminar were putting forward that image of Jesus as one who spends his life in order to build up the life of others, I would applaud their work utterly. Because that is the image of Jesus which is not found in historical reconstruction, but in the very literary fabric of the Gospels themselves. And I would argue that a lot of Christian churches who are very concerned about other cultural realities grievously miss that Jesus, just as much as the historical reconstructions miss that Jesus.
All right. We'll talk next with someone in Evanston. It's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I must say that I have a great deal of difficulty with what you said this morning, especially your response to the previous gentleman. You supposedly have written a book that is a critique of Crossan and Spahn and the other individuals who have done historical research in the life of Jesus, which is not unusual. Schweitzer, Romain did the same sort of things. They're not exactly groundbreakers as far as that's concerned.
Not at all.
But your critique is on the characters of Crossan and Spahn.
Not at all.
As I have listened to you, sir, you're not dealing with their historical research. There is no substance in your criticism so far. You have not dealt with one aspect of their criticism of the historical Jesus.
In fact, in the book I do in considerable detail, and this is a talk show, it's not a book. Let me say first that some of their criteria everybody grants. For example, the criterion of multiple attestation. In other words, if three sources say something, there's a larger chance that it was actually historical than if only one says it, right? A second principle, or two other principles, are much more problematic. And the first one is called the principle of dissimilarity. And what this proposes is this. We can say that Jesus did something or said something historically if, and only if, it can be demonstrated that it was dissimilar, that is, unlike anything else that was said in Judaism before his time, and anything that was carried on by the early church. In other words, it's a criterion of uniqueness. The difficulty with this criterion in historical terms, sir, is that it is, first of all, impossible of execution. In other words, it can't be carried out. You can pretend to carry it out, but you can't really carry it out. And the reason is that we don't have everything that was said in Judaism before the time of Jesus, and we don't have everything that was handed on in the early church. So therefore, although the criterion looks quite rigorous in theory, in practice it simply can't be carried out. Now, in other words, there are logical problems built into the very process. And these are exactly the criteria used by John Dominic Crossan in his major work, The Historical Jesus. Everywhere he uses those criteria. And they simply are non-probative on the strictly scientific grounds.
May I ask you just a specific question? As a physicist, are you able to give me a biography of Mark Luth, John, Matthew?
Of course not. I've already told a previous caller that we don't even know who these people are.
You don't know who they are?
Of course not.
Well, sir, in science, I think that would just be thrown out of the window immediately.
Well, any further comment, Professor Johnson?
No, I can't comment on that.
All right. Well, I don't know that we'll be able to satisfy the caller. I appreciate his comment. And also, I would not want people to come away from our conversation with the idea that your argument against some of the people that we have mentioned and who have been on this program is simply an ad hominem argument. It's not. But obviously, one would really have to look at your book to see that. So again, what you know, I would suggest it's with a lot of people we talk to on this program where we barely scratch the surface of the topic that they they should go on and take a look.
Could I simply say before the next caller, if we have time for it, is that in some sense my original title for this book was Scholarship in the Culture Wars, and typically the publisher didn't think that was catchy enough, so they gave it a catchier title. But chapter 3 of my book, which talks about cultural confusion, is really the heart of the argument. And what I try to say is that precisely what is happening this morning on this talk show is the problem. That is, people like myself who have trained for 30 years, you know, who have carried out real historical investigations, people like John Dominic Crossan, who's also, you know, done fine, you know, historical work, come on a show, and it becomes like the Oprah Winfrey thing, or like a barroom discussion. And matters of very serious import, and matters of considerable nuance, become distorted by the kind of give and take of an adversarial relationship. And I regret that. And I mean, I really do appreciate programs like this for giving both sides of the question, for bringing scholars on board. I applaud you for that. But I must say that I'm sure, as it is for you, it's deeply frustrating for me to get into what in effect becomes a kind of a shouting match when that's not the tone of my book and it's not the point of the program.
And that is Luke Timothy Johnson. He's professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. He was a guest on this program, then we called it Focus 580, in November of 1996. And we were talking about his book, The Real Jesus. The subtitle is The Misguided Quest for the Historical Jesus and the Truth of the Historical Gospels. This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and one thing we thought we might do to celebrate would be to bring back some of these programs, programs that are not part of the web archive. In most cases, they haven't been heard since they were first broadcast, but we think that the guests and the topics were interesting and were worth another hearing. We've called it the Deep Archives Project. This is the last. You can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. Near the top, you'll find a place you can leave a comment. You can also drop us a line at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip code is 61801.
Today's programs are made possible by the Courier Cafe, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. Whether it's almond French toast for breakfast, garden fresh salads and homemade soups for lunch, or burgers and hand-dipped shakes for dinner, the Courier Cafe in downtown Urbana has been offering fresh choices for 30 years.
And that's it for Focus for this morning. We want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. We go now to Kansas City, where we check in on the March wheat contract. It's trading at 657 and three quarters, down three quarters. The May contract, 666 and a half, down one. December wheat in Chicago, 567 and three quarters, down nine. March, 593, down four. December corn, 579 and three quarters, down 10 and a quarter. March, 589 and a half, down 10 and three quarters. May, 598, down 10 and three quarters. July, 604 and a half, down 10. January soybeans, 1107 and three quarters, down 24 and three quarters. March, 1117 and a half, down 24 and three quarters. May, 1128, down 24 and a half. July, 1137 and a half, down 24 and three quarters. December soybean meal, 276.80, down 5.90. The December oil contract, 49.04, down 116. December live cattle, 118.35, down 107 and a half. February, 118.82 and a half, down 77 and a half. January feeder cattle, 142.05, down 42 and a half. December lean hogs, 85.50. That contract is up 67 and a half.
Outside markets next. January crude oil, 98.39. That is up 4. The U.S. dollar, 78.69, down 14. The CRB index, 305.46, down 249. The Dow is up 173 points at 12,170. The S&P 500 up 20 at 1254. And the NASDAQ is up 43 at 20.